third text. Chapter is called Divine, Divinity and Divine Service. Sutta Uvacha. Yam Pavajan Tham Upetam Apeta Kutyam Ayano Viraha Katra Juhava Upetitam Mat Yatyata Tarova Vinedu Samsagabhuta Irayam Munim Manantusmi. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Srila Sutta Goswami said, "Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto that great sage, Shukadeva Goswami, who can enter the hearts of all. When he went away to take up the renounced order of life, sannyas, leaving home without undergoing reformation by the sacred thread or the ceremonies observed by the higher castes, his father Vyasadeva, fearing separation from him, cried out, 'O my son, indeed, only the trees, which were absorbed in the same feelings of separation, echoed in response to the bereaved father, purport, by Srila Prabhupada. The institution of varna and ashram prescribes many regulative duties to be observed by its followers. Such duties enjoin that a candidate willing to study the Vedas must approach a bona fide spiritual master and request acceptance as his disciple. The sacred thread is the sign of those who are competent to study the Vedas from the Acharya or the bona fide spiritual master. Sri Shukadeva Goswami did not undergo such purificatory ceremonies because he was liberated. He was a liberated soul from his very birth. Generally, a man is born as an ordinary being and by the purificatory processes. He is born for the second time. When he sees a new light and seeks direction for spiritual progress, he approaches a spiritual master for instruction in the Vedas. The spiritual master accepts only the sincere inquirer as his disciple and gives him the sacred thread. In this way, a man becomes twice born, or dvija. After qualifying as a dvija, one may study the Vedas. And after becoming well-versed in the Vedas, one becomes a vipra. A vipra, or qualified Brahman, thus realizes the absolute truth and makes further progress in spiritual life until he reaches the Vaishnava stage. The Vaishnava stage is the postgraduate status of a Brahman. A progressive Brahman must necessarily become a Vaishnava, for a Vaishnava is a self-realized, learned Brahman. Srila Shukadeva Goswami was a Vaishnava from the beginning. Therefore, there was no need for him to undergo all the processes of the Varnashram institution. Ultimately, the aim of Varnashram Dharma is to turn a crude man into a pure devotee of the Lord or a Vaishnava. Anyone, therefore, who becomes a Vaishnava, accepted by the first-class Vaishnava or Uttama Adhikari Vaishnava, is already considered a Brahman, regardless of his birth or past deeds. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted this principle and recognized Srila Haridas Thakur as the Acharya of the Holy Name, although Thakur Haridas appeared in a Mohammedan family. In conclusion, Srila Shukadeva Goswami was born a Vaishnava, and therefore Brahmanism was included in him. He did not have to undergo any ceremonies. Any low-born person, be he a Kirata, Huna, Andhra, Pulinda, Pulkasha, Abhira, Shumba, Yavana, Kasa, or even lower, can be delivered to the highest transcendental position by the mercy of Vaishnavas. Srila Shukadeva Goswami was the spiritual master of Sri Sutta Goswami, who therefore offers his respectful obeisances unto Srila Shukadeva Goswami before he begins his answers to the questions of the sages of Naimasharanya. Om Agnati Mirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksuru Nidhikam Jena Dasmai Sri Gurave Maha Sri Chaitanya Manovistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Svayam Rupapita Mayam Dharati Svapranti Aham. When I was reading this verse, which starts out, Srila Suta Goswami said, or reminded me of another verse in the fourth chapter of the same canto. And Prabhupada's explanation of realization is so brilliant that I thought I should read it before speaking. So I'm going to just, if you'll indulge me, read this other verse, which is a particularly beautiful and brilliant explanation. The verse says, on hearing Suta Goswami speak thus, Shonaka Muni, who was the elderly learned leader of all the rishis, engaged in that prolonged sacrificial ceremony, congratulated Suta Goswami by addressing him as follows. And this is what Prabhupada writes in his purport. In a meeting of learned men, when there are congratulations or addresses for the speaker, the qualifications of the congratulator should be as follows. He must be the leader of the house and an elderly man. He must be vastly learned also. Sri Shonaka Rishi had all these qualifications, and thus he stood up to congratulate Sri Suta Goswami when he expressed his desire to present Srimad Bhagavatam exactly as he heard it from Shukadeva Goswami and also realized it personally. Personal realization does not mean that one should, out of vanity, attempt to show one's own learning by trying to surpass the previous acharya. He must have full confidence in the previous acharya, and at the same time, he must realize the subject matter so nicely that he can present the matter for the particular circumstances in a suitable manner. The original purpose of the text must be maintained. That sentence is in italics, which means that Prabhupada wanted to emphasize that sentence. The original purpose of the text must be maintained. No obscure meaning should be screwed out of it, yet it should be presented in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience. This is called realization. The leader of the assembly, Shonaka, could estimate the value of the speaker, Sri Suta Goswami, simply by uttering yathaditam and yathamati, and therefore he was very glad to congratulate him in ecstasy. No learned man should be willing to hear a person who does not represent the original acharya. So the speaker and the audience were bona fide in this meeting, where Bhagavatam was being recited for the second time. That should be the standard of recitation of Bhagavatam, so that the real purpose can be served without difficulty. Unless this situation is created, Bhagavatam recitation for extraneous purposes is useless labor, both for the speaker and for the audience. This is a particularly brilliant explanation of the meaning of realization. An explanation by Srila Prabhupada. And we understand many things from this. First of all, we understand that Shukadeva Goswami spoke the Bhagavatam, but his words weren't repeated verbatim. They were repeated by Suta Goswami, but he spoke according to his own realization. Not that he was like a just trying to repeat everything word for word, syllable by syllable, letter for letter, but he was speaking from his own realization. And Prabhupada explains what realization means. He says that the original purpose of the text must be maintained. So in Sanskrit we call this siddhanta. We have to try to understand what the acharyas meant. Not simply, we don't simply try to repeat what they said, but we try to understand what they meant. And this is called realization. This is the reason why personalities like Srila Prabhupada are so glorified in society. This is the reason why great personalities are remembered in society. This is the reason why persons like Srila Prabhupada have a great influence on society. This is the reason why great personalities change millions of lives. This is the reason why great personalities establish a philosophy, even if such a philosophy is not popular. Even if such a philosophy is not likable by what Prabhupada calls crude people, crude men. One of the marks of a truly great person is that they can create a taste, they can create a thirst and a hunger for something which is ordinarily not sought after. People generally want to feel that their senses are gratified in some way or other. And marketeers pride themselves in being able to tailor their product or their service to the tastes of whatever public they're trying to reach. But truly great, maybe we could say revolutionary, person like Srila Prabhupada didn't pander to the tastes of anyone, any public, but he succeeded in creating a taste where there was no taste. Even among crude people who had no taste for anything transcendental, the mark of greatness is that even among such persons, even in the midst of such an atmosphere that is so against anything spiritual, somehow a taste is created. And as Prabhupada has written, if the original meaning of the text is maintained, then that taste can be manifest within the heart of anyone. And that is how, according to what we read, how hearts are changed. Hard hearts become soft hearts. And crude people become sensitive people. And atheistic people can become theistic people. This is a radical transformation to go from atheist to theist. This is realization. Sometimes we've heard Prabhupada say that, why am I being glorified? I have done nothing unusual. All I've done is try to preserve what I've learned, what I've heard, what I've read. All I have tried to do is pass on what has been taught to me without any change, without any adulteration, without any personal motive. And if there's anything that can be said for my having done anything, and he was very reluctant to even say my, he would usually say we, it's because I haven't changed anything. It's because this is the genuine article. It's not diluted, it's not watered down, it's not changed. So realization, from what we understand from Prabhupada's words here, is somehow to preserve the original meaning. And yet, within preserving that original meaning, as he says, you must have full confidence in the previous acharya, just like we. It's very similar, isn't it,
the way we have great confidence in Srila Prabhupada. Some of us have never physically met him or laid eyes on him in person. And we're so convinced, we have such, we can call it blind faith almost, that he's a perfect person, that he hasn't changed anything. Of course, we've heard his, we've read his books, we've heard his tapes, we've watched his videos, and we've heard it said so many times that he didn't change anything. No obscure meaning should be screwed out of it, yet, Prabhupada writes, it should be presented in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience. So every audience is different. Every part of the world has its own traditions, its own religions, its own standards of behavior, traditions. And it's different everywhere. The way people act in Thailand and Australia and South Africa and Iceland and India and America, they're all different. So Prabhupada, who is a world preacher and preached in all these parts of the world, was able to somehow preserve all of the great things, all of the great original teachings, without changing the meaning of them, preserving the Siddhanta, and yet he created a taste where there was no taste. He created a market where there was no market. He created an interest where there was no interest. He created devotees where there were no devotees. He changed atheists to theists. And there's an incident that probably many of you have heard before, where Prabhupada was in a train compartment and one of his compatriots asked him to perform a miracle. Someone wanted him to show a universal form, or to levitate, or to become invisible, or to make something else disappear. And there were devotees in the same compartment. Some of them were shaved, wearing tilaks. And Prabhupada thought for a few seconds, and then he gestured to his devotees and he said, "This is my miracle. This is my miracle. White people with shaved heads and tilaks and dhotis and ladies in saris." So there is no greater miracle, because we can understand, and I think we all know, that these people were, at least many of them, atheists, or agnostics at least, and yet somehow this miracle occurred. They transformed. They became what Prabhupada called mad after God, or someone said that to him, that these people, they're mad after God. And Prabhupada quoted something once from, I think it was from a Shakespeare play. It said something like, and this is also a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam. The idea is that the lover, the poet, and the madman are all compact in mind. And it's also stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam that the people who are truly content are either completely self-realized, like Das and Sudha Goswami and Sudhadeva Goswami, completely detached, or they're completely mad. They don't care about anything. Those are the people who are really content with the world. So in a sense, to be on the transcendental path, to be a serious aspirant to spiritual life, means to be a little mad. We're all a little bit mad, maybe. We're sitting here hearing about a little blue boy playing a flute, has lots of girlfriends, loved butter, used to steal butter, had lots of girlfriends, made sure a lot of people died in the Kurukshetra War, who was a thief, a philanderer, and a killer, and yet we think he's God. This murderer, this philanderer, this thief, who was running after people to get the dust from their feet, to liberate the whole world, if that's God. You have to be a little bit mad little bit crazy. Prabhupada told a story about a person who was accused of murder in a court case, and the civil servant was called in, the physician, psychiatrist, to determine whether he could be freed on insanity plea. And he said, "Your worship," they used to call him "Your worship" in those days. "As far as I'm concerned, they're all crazy. Anyone who commits murder, he's crazy. So if you're going to let this guy go, you're going to have to let them all go." So we've heard Prabhupada even say this from time to time, that to be a devotee means to be a little crazy. Because when we look around us, everyone is after happiness from the senses, happiness from films and boats and cars and planes and material progress, education, beauty, wealth, material progress, aristocracy. Everyone thinks these things are just wonderful. And someone who doesn't think such things are wonderful, but that they're worth sacrificing their lives for, are a little bit crazy. But that's all right. Actually, people like Hare Krishnas partly because they are a little crazy. They don't sit in front of the TV with a beer in one hand, petting the dog in the other hand all day long. There's something else. Something else that they get pleasure from. Something they don't understand. Something invisible. There's something within. And the Bhagavad Gita tells us that one whose happiness is within, who is active and rejoices within him, whose aim is inward. That person is the perfect mystic and is liberated and supreme, ultimately attains the supreme. So what is this inner joy? Why are we being entertained so much? What is it? This thing that we can't see that's making us so happy, so content. Isn't it more of a contentedness than a happiness? It's not passionate, it's not frivolous, but we just feel satisfied. Lord Chaitanya gave his disciples a very big project. He wanted that everybody in the whole, not just people in little rooms or in temples listening to philosophy or lectures about Krishna consciousness, they should be happy. But he wanted the whole world, not just human beings, but everybody. So he talked about the flood of love of God that Lord Chaitanya began. And when there's a flood, as everyone knows, even the snakes are buoyed up to the top of the water. So the metaphor of a flood is very appropriate. Lord Chaitanya started something. He started this great flood. And Prabhupada didn't see himself as somebody great who started something called ISKCON. But he saw that this was something that Krishna himself started 5,000 years ago, that Lord Chaitanya promoted and made even more widespread 500 years ago. Sometimes it's thought, sometimes people criticize Hare Krishna. Oh, you watch TV, you have all these cell phones, and you're driving cars. Once I was getting into a car in San Diego, and some girls were walking by, riding by on their bicycles. I didn't think you people drove cars. So in one way, the great thing, gift that Prabhupada gave us was to show us that there's nothing wrong with driving cars, or fixing cars, or using cell phones, or cameras. Once Sandeep was with me and a few other people, and we walked up to the top of Mount Warning. Mount Warning is the place in eastern Australia where the sun first hits that continent, that big island. And we got to the top at about 11 o'clock. It's a pretty rigorous climb. We had to go through a rainforest and then climbed over some rocks. And we got to the top, and there was a fellow who had been staying all night to watch the sunrise, and he was still in his, I guess he'd gone back to sleep in his sleeping bag. And he saw my video camera. And he just stared at that video camera. The first thing he said, first words out of his mouth was, "What, where's your cell phone, Baba?" Once I was passing through the customs in New Zealand, and I had my stroller thing full of suitcases, little baggage rack, and somehow he just looked at me. It was in kind of the last phase. That's an awful lot of stuff for a monk. Go over to the Red Channel, and then they opened everything and examined all of my bags. And it was a very long, tedious process. So sometimes my point is that people look at us sideways because we use all this technology. How can we do it? I'm talking on a microphone, someone's recording this. But this is what Prabhupada gave us, wasn't it? And really, it's not just Prabhupada's gift, it's Rupa Goswami's gift. It's Yukta Vairagya, it's in the Bhagavad Gita. And sometimes we think that, we see all these tapes of Prabhupada. We hear all these audio cassettes of Prabhupada. We have so many books, thousands and thousands, and maybe millions of books and pamphlets. And we hear this great music. The devotees singing such beautiful songs in Vrindavan, we can hear them on tapes and on CDs. And Prabhupada made all this possible. In the wake of Lord Chaitanya, it is spread all over the world. Previous to Prabhupada and maybe to Bhaktisiddhanta, not too far back, maybe 100 years ago, people, they might have a guru somewhere in some remote part of India, and the guru might have one or two disciples. But now Prabhupada has created, he is the Param Guru, and he's created this wonderful ability to see him on tape, to hear him, to see his, to read his books, to go to his temples in every part of the world, to go into his restaurants, to be with devotees everywhere, to hear the holy name chanted on the street corners, on the streets and byways of every major city of the world. And that's truly amazing. How has this happened in just 10 years, 15, 20, maybe 30 years? But it was even happening in the first 10 years because Prabhupada was relentlessly traveling. And what was he teaching? What was he saying? What was different about him? He possessed realization. He wasn't changing anything. He was giving us the Siddhanta. He was presenting what had been presented thousands of years ago by Lord Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. Wasn't doing anything different. I heard one tape, Prabhupada was speaking in Durban, and one of the audience, a man who sounded like he had an Indian accent, said, "Now, please show us your universal forms." And there was a long silence, and then Prabhupada said, "What? You're asking me?" Like, he was just incredulous. And he said, "Yes, show us your universal form." I said, "I can show you a universal form." He said, "I don't have this kind of power. What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, you must have some kind of power. You have so many students, so many disciples, so many temples all over the world. Certainly, and so many books. You must have power." And Prabhupada thought for a minute, and he said, "My only power is to tell the fools and rascals of the world that Krishna is God. That's all." So he very nicely put this person in his place without offending him, without directly calling him a fool or a rascal. But that's the miracle of passing on truth, real truth, not relative truth, but absolute truth. And that's the real gift, isn't it? Isn't that the gift that Prabhupada gives? Because everything in this world that we see, everything that we enjoy, everyone that we meet, everything is surrounded by relativity. Even morality. If someone thinks I'm obedient, I'm good, I'm faithful and honest, whatever honesty may be in anyone's mind, that's it. That's morality. Whatever anyone believes is moral and good and loyal and honest and faithful and obedient, that's morality. But Prabhupada said something very different, something very unusual, and he called it absolute. That's a word that people shrink from, they revolt from,
the idea that
something can be absolute, or that a person can be perfect. How can a person be perfect? Everything and everyone is just full of flaws. There's no such thing as perfect. But we're here sitting in this room because we think that there is such a thing as perfection in a person. We think that there is such a thing as absolute. We think that a philosophy can be perfect. And that may be a bit mad, but if that is what truth is, then better to be a little mad than to be completely engulfed in sense gratification and thinking that everything is relative and not having any fixed purpose in life. This fixed purpose is very important. It's mentioned in Vyavasaya Nikabuddhi, Ekeha Kuru Nandana, that we should be very focused in our mind. We may be doing many different things. We may have many responsibilities to carry out, and we do, and we have to carry them out because everything we do belongs to Krishna. Our own possessions, our own family, our own appearance, our own clothes, our own body, everything belongs to Krishna. So we have to take care of it. We have these responsibilities. The transcendentalist who is fixed, the other side, Ekeha Kuru Nandana, the one who is fixed and one-minded, is never deviated, even in the midst of so many responsibilities. Because we have so many things we have to do just to pay the rent, just to earn a living. So many forms to fill out, so many numbers to crunch. But a transcendentalist is Ekeha Kuru Nandana. Vyavasaya Nikabuddhi, Ekeha Kuru Nandana. Not diverted, not dissuaded from original purpose. It's kind of like, sometimes it is said that spiritual life is like a razor's edge. It's kind of like walking a tightrope, isn't it? Without getting distracted. And the tightrope walkers, they have to concentrate. It's very dangerous. Have you ever seen them in the circus? I've seen them without any nets underneath. It looks so easy. But they have to concentrate very, very hard to make sure that they don't lose their balance. And it's very easy. It's very easy in spiritual life to lose balance. Very, very easy, because temptations are on every side, from above, from below, and from every side. So when we have been told that spiritual life is like declaring war on Maya, the soldier is very one-pointed in the mind. And to do so many things, put on the boots, to cock the guns, to make sure the pins and the hand grenades are all in the right place. But the whole point is to win a war. That's the focus. That's the mission. So, I remember reading one of Ravindra Sarupa Prabhu's offerings in Vyasa Puja, and he very beautifully compared Prabhupada to a general. He said that he saw, I'm sure some of you have read this offering from a few years back, a file was Prabhupada's incoming letters. And in that file were letters from people who were Prabhupada's leaders. They were having all kinds of problems, all kinds of problems. Serious spiritual difficulties. Not just little problems, but big problems. And they were the leaders. And in his offering he said, well, maybe I shouldn't have seen this file, but I did see it. And by seeing it, he marveled all the more that Prabhupada knew about all these things that were going on, all these very difficult situations that were arising. And yet, he didn't appear ever to flag, even slightly. He never appeared to get deviated from his purpose. And in this way, Ravindra Sarupa compared him to a general, because in the army, the generals, the lieutenants, the captains, they see their men die and they see them mutilated. And they see horror happen right before their eyes, time after time. But they don't flag. They know they've got to win. They know they've got to carry out their mission, their duty. So this was how this great devotee thought of Srila Prabhupada as a great general who, in the midst of so many difficulties, so many temptations to have to placate people, to have to counsel them, to explain things. Somehow he, and he did all that. It's not that he didn't do it. He wrote letters every day, sometimes 15, 20 letters a day. When we would see him in his room, say in London, and he was holding a darshan, he would be thinking about what was going on in Hawaii, in Buenos Aires, in Melbourne, in Moscow. He would be meditating on very complex, difficult, legal, social, personal problems that would take judges years to solve. He was solving them one after the other just by writing letters. So he was never deviated, even though he had every reason to be deviated, but he never deviated. He was very fixed, Devasaya, very, very singular in his purpose. He told some of his disciples who were promoting his understanding of science, he told them that if I say these things, people say, oh, he's an old man, what does he know? But if you say these things, you're a scientist, you're a PhD, you've got lots of experience, you're an author, you've written papers, you've been published, you're a teacher, you've worked with people, and then they're going to believe you. But why should they? I mean, why should they even stick their necks out and say something that's so revolutionary, so against the grain? But Prabhupada was so convinced, that, for example, if the moon is farther away than the sun, that we never went to the moon. He was so convinced, so absolutely certain, so sure, that even the scientists said, yes, this is the truth. And even if we have to defy everything that our teachers have told us, everything that's written in the textbooks, everything that we have to nod our heads to and say yes to the instructors in our classrooms, if we have to write books that counter everything that's in all the other books, history books, science books, whatever they may be, we're going to do it. Why? Because Prabhupada is convinced. And not only was he convinced, but he had, this was knowledge that he didn't invent. This is knowledge that's eternal. This is not just 1,500 years old. And it's not just 5,000 years old from the time it was written, but it goes back and back and back to time immemorial. These truths, one of our presidents wrote, are self-evident. But the real self-evident truths are the truths of the Vedas, the truths of Lord Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. And it's these Siddhantas that make us feel very, very satisfied. When we've heard that Prabhupada wanted Varnashram Dharma to be widespread, sometimes we misunderstand and we expect that everyone has to immediately stand up and identify themselves. I'm a Kshatriya, I'm a Brahmin, I'm a Shudra. But actually he wanted everyone in the world to be involved, to be acting in some way that was Haritosham, that was satisfying the Lord Hari. So Prabhupada, he actually took on the whole world. When he wanted something like Varnashram, we're talking here about major social agenda, social change. And this doesn't happen overnight. This doesn't happen in 1 week or 1 year or 10 or 20 years. This may take centuries. Prabhupada sometimes referred to Marxist philosophy. Karl Marx in his lifetime was thought to be kind of a crazy, bearded, grizzled, poor, hopeless philosopher. But in time, he wrote a lot of books. His philosophy came to rule for about 70, 80 years, a very large number of people, 400 million or so. So it was Prabhupada's conviction that his books might take a long time for people to understand and to act on, but that they would affect major change, not just in four. This was Prabhupada's conviction. He wanted the whole world, not just 400 million, but we're talking in terms of billions of people to be affected. And he's written like this. So it's a big assignment. It's a big mission that he's laid out before us to do our best. And even if we don't get all 6 billion people, if we just get even one person to really understand, then Prabhupada quoted that famous saying that one moon is better than millions of stars. So, in the wake of a great person, one can feel content, even if someone gets a little prasadam and likes it. Even if someone likes the hospitality of a devotional service and a devotee, even if someone likes the devotee, that's a step in the right direction. That's a step towards satisfying the whole world. At least in Prabhupada's eyes, that was a significant step. And according to what he said about realization, we should act in such a way that everyone is pleased. He says, personal realization does not mean that one should out of vanity attempt to show one's own learning by trying to surpass the previous acharya. He must have full confidence in the previous acharya. At the same time, he must realize the subject matter so nicely that he can present the matter for the particular circumstances in a suitable manner. Now, are we doing that? Are we presenting the subject matter in a suitable manner? Are we realized? So realization is not such a small, insignificant thing. It's the essence of being Krishna conscious, is to realize. It's not just to understand. We can understand so many things, I'm not this body, intellectually. But how many of us actually realize that? And how many of us act in a realized way? How many of us are actually not changing the original purpose of the text, not screwing out any obscure meaning, and yet presenting the philosophy somehow in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience? This is called realization, Prabhupada says. So it's a big task, not an easy task that he has laid before us. And there are many, many ways that we're all engaged in. And I don't mean to be critical, because I'm probably the worst offender at not being able to say things in a suitable way to please. But there are so many ways Prabhupada has given us. He talked about culture and cultural conquest. He produced beautiful paintings in his books. He loved beautiful architecture. He loved beautiful music when it was applied to Krishna consciousness. So he understood how people, especially in the West, because in India, if your clothes are a little bit wrinkled, or if your beard's grown out a little bit, it's really not so offensive. You know, you're a sadhu. But Prabhupada came to the most materialistic part of the world, came to New York City, came to the concrete jungle, where people really do look you up and down. When we were in London, he looked at me once and he said, "Your coat is a little soiled." Yeah. And then he said, "In London you dress, then address." You understand? Dress, then address. Oh yes, Prabhupada, I understand. Little things like that, I mean, it means so much. Because they did. People in London, they used to look us up and down. What kind of shoes are you wearing? Well, you know, if there's a little mark on your coat, it doesn't go unnoticed. You're out. You don't count. So it was just things like that. Prabhupada, he noticed everything. And I think you know this. Some of you have read Dhanavir Prabhu's Maharaj's book. Some of us were criticized because a woman was singing Govinda Mari Purusham Samandajam in the early days. And we were all devastated. We heard, oh, Prabhupada didn't like this. That a woman singing Govinda. And we had worked so hard to make this a reality. We'd gone into the recording studio. We you know, really thought that this was going to change, you know, in those days. Change the world. But then when we heard Prabhupada doesn't like it, it's no good, all out the window. So then Prabhupada actually hadn't heard it, but someone started this rumor that Prabhupada didn't like it. So in the temple room, Prabhupada was in his Vyasa-san, and the The doors in the Los Angeles temple were open and the deities were exposed. And then Prabhupada took one of his ways and said, what is that record from London? And they said, oh, yes. And Prabhupada said, well, I haven't heard it. And could you play it? And they said, oh, yes, we'll play it. So then some time went by. And Prabhupada said, why are you hesitating? Play it. And the devotee said, you mean, play it here on the speaker system in front of everybody in the deities on the big loud speakers?